Confronting Everyday Sexism in Brazil on the World. I'm Marco Werman. A shocking sexual assault case has Brazilians talking about sexism in all its forms. The Sao Paulo resident says that includes women-only cars on the city's subway system.
Which means Brazilian state is telling everyone, men and women, that the best way it can protect me as a woman is to keep me apart from men.
Also, what it's like to live in constant fear of deportation.
People become very afraid and the rumors start up. Before an arrest even happens, the harm is already done.
Plus, we visit a vegan cafe in Tbilisi that became a target for sausage-wielding extremists. I am not making that up. That's all today here on The World. Thank you for being here today. All eyes are on Brazil as the country prepares to host the Olympics this summer. Unfortunately, the view is not pretty. There's economic turmoil, the Zika outbreak, political scandal, and charges of rampant corruption. In a moment, we'll dig into the latest on the political scandal and whether there are any ways around impeachment for President Dilma Rousseff. Right now, though, even the scandals are getting eclipsed in Brazil by a horrific thing that happened last month in a Rio slum. A 16-year-old girl attacked and gang-raped by as many as 30 men. Since then, there have been protests and demands for not just better protection for women, but also a change in the culture in Brazil. To find out more, we reach Manuela Miklos. She's a social scientist and an activist in Sao Paulo. And she says the victim in the case has been speaking to the media about her ordeal.
She gave an interview to the most watched show last Sunday, and she was really calm and gave her account of what happened. The most moving part of it was, in the end, the interviewer asking her what she hoped for those men, what she desired that would happen to them. And she just said, I wish they had daughters.
Oh, wow. That's heavy.
Yeah.
Manuela, how unusual is a case like this in Brazil?
A case like this is, of course, unusual in terms of the number of men involved. But violence against women and rape are not unusual at all. A woman is raped every 11 minutes in Brazil. So it is happening as we speak. It is Brazil is part of rape culture.
Well, let's talk about the culture behind that rape culture. I mean, you're a social scientist and activist. You're also a woman. Describe what everyday sexism is like for you in Brazil.
Rape culture in Brazil is all about creating a sense of what's normal. And to be normal is to be a male, to be rich, and to be white, which describes just a little minority of our society. I think the best way to describe is I take the metro every day to work, and the metro has a different car for women.
So they can feel protected in that.
So they can feel protected, which means Brazilian state is telling everyone, men and women, that the best way it can protect me as a woman is to keep me apart from men.
I know there have been protests in several cities across Brazil in response to this horrific gang rape. Have you been to any of them?
Yeah, I did. I went to a protest on the weekend, and there will be new ones today all over the country. They're scheduled for tonight.
What are they like? I mean, what kind of things are you hearing from people?
It's very powerful to be part of those. In Rio, there was a lot of women downtown in the center and women telling their stories of violence and men around looking, a lot of them crying. So it is a moment for women to get together and men to hear, which is in itself unusual and hopefully will change the way we feel about those episodes.
What are the solutions in your mind to this problem? I mean, how do you even start to address this culture of, you know, male domination over women in Brazil?
First, it is important that we're having a national debate on it. All women knew this was going on and we never spoke. So it's a time to speak and for men to listen and to reflect on their actions. The other thing is we have to think about education. We have to think about how we deal with the images of women in our society. There's a lot of work to be done. And of course, we have to get justice for this girl. And to me, it seems we have appropriate laws to deal with. What we have on paper looks really good. It's just that it's never put into practice.
Manuela Miklos, a social scientist and an activist in Sao Paulo. Of course, Brazil was already dealing with the political crisis I mentioned earlier. President Dilma Rousseff was recently suspended from office while lawmakers consider impeachment. She's accused of misusing government money. Most Brazilians seem to be in favor of her impeachment, but now many are questioning the entire process. So Dilma might still survive. For an update, I spoke with the world's Will Carlos in Rio.
A lot of people wanted to sort of be rid of Dilma. But at the same time, I think a lot of people think that the process by which she was gotten rid of, or at least gotten rid of temporarily, was pretty underhand and was largely engineered by sort of interests who are sort of trying to get rid of this huge graft investigation that's been going on and that she was largely supportive of. So the sort of conspiracy theory that's actually become less of a conspiracy theory and more sort of mainstream is that the whole thing was engineered to make this big corruption scandal go away. And now that sort of more and more is coming out about that, more and more people are sort of getting upset with the impeachment and the way that it all came about.
Right. Do those critics have a point?
Yeah, I think they do have a point. I mean, in the last couple of weeks, you've seen two of Michel Temer, the new acting president's ministers, have to step down after embarrassing leaks showed them talking in sort of disparaging terms or basically sort of plotting to get rid of this investigation. So there's clearly some evidence that, you know, that was part of the reasoning behind the way that this was done. At the same time, I mean, this was arguably a democratic process. It was all constitutional. And so the argument that it was a sort of a traditional coup, I think, is less strong.
Is there any way Dilma can save her presidency by rallying congressional support back on her side?
We need to be clear. She has not been impeached at this stage. She is on trial for impeachment. Now, in a few months after that trial is concluded, there will be a new vote of the Senate. And the crucial thing about this new vote is that 2/3 of the senators must vote to actually finally impeach her. Now, that's a very high hurdle to get over. And to give you some context, the last time the Senate voted to put her on trial, 55 senators voted to put her on trial for impeachment. Well, 2/3 of senators is 54. So in theory, all Dilma needs to do over the coming weeks and months is to sort of flip two of those senators and get them on her side. And in theory, she could survive that vote and could come back.
All right, two senators. But if that fails, is there any other way for Dilma to win her fight?
So if that fails, no. If that fails, she's done. I mean, if she's voted out in that final vote, then she must step down. She's not allowed to run for office again. And Michel Temer, the acting vice president, will in all likelihood sort of see out the rest of her term.
I got to say, this impeachment story in Brazil, Will, it feels like nesting dolls, a story within a story within another story. Where does it all stop?
Oh, who knows, Marco? I mean, this continues unreeling, and it's very interesting for journalists here and hopefully for the listeners, too, to kind of watch this play out. I mean, you know, if she is finally impeached, then I think things may calm down for a little bit. But in Brazil, I mean, who knows? I'm wary of making any such predictions.
The world's Will Carlos in Rio de Janeiro. Thanks, as always, Will.
Always a pleasure. Thanks.
The Tiger Temple in Thailand is probably not what you think of when I say Buddhist sanctuary. It is a popular tourist destination. The monks of the temple run it like a zoo, charging admission to see animals, including tigers. The Tiger Temple's faced opposition in the past, but today Thai officials raided it and found a very grim scene, 40 dead tiger cubs in a freezer. Reporter Adam Ramsey was at the Tiger Temple when authorities first went in to investigate. Earlier today, he spoke with my colleague, Carol Hills.
Adam Ramsey, you've been to the Tiger Temple. What prompted this raid?
I mean, it's been years in the making. International and local NGOs have been calling out this Tiger Temple for animal abuse, illegal trafficking, illegal selling. So it's actually more a question of why did it take so long? But nonetheless, on Monday, they finally decided that it was time to raid the Tiger Temple.
What have officials found so far?
When they first entered the Tiger Temple, they had announced 2 days before that they were going to relocate 137 tigers. They knew that that was what they were going to do. So they came prepared. They had their tranquilizer guns. They knew where and which tigers that they were going to try and get, which would be the easiest to place into the cages and then drive them to the research center where they're due to be held.
And how many tigers are we talking about that are being relocated?
Currently, it's 137 Indo-Chinese tigers. And now they are, over the next 7 days, aiming to remove about 20 a day. They're pretty much at that level right now.
Have they had direct evidence of animal or animal parts trafficking that they could, charge these Buddhist monks with a crime?
Actually, yes. There's a NGO based in Australia called Sea for Life, and they have pretty damning evidence, including video interviews, which sort of indicate that illegal tiger trade was happening as late as Christmas 2014.
Now, are these monks going to be charged with anything in this latest case?
That's really hard to say. So this NGO put forward their body of evidence and they gave it to the Royal Thai Police, and they're sort of waiting on that to happen. But what I think is very important to stress here is that the low-level staff who work at Tiger Temple have absolutely nothing to do with it. It's surprising. They really don't know very much except that they absolutely love their tigers. They really look after them well. And I have to say that in terms of the zoos that I've been to in Thailand, in terms of the conditions that the tigers are currently staying in, they are far superior. The only problem is that there are these very serious allegations of illegal trade in endangered tigers.
What are the monks saying in terms of why they had these frozen corpses of tiger cubs in their freezers?
Well, the monks themselves are completely silent. They're not speaking to anybody about this. But the staff that are on the ground mentioned that in 2010, their vet had changed their policy about any tiger cubs which happened to die. And they used to cremate them, but now they decided to freeze them because they were facing more and more accusations of selling tiger cubs on the black market. So it was meant to act as proof that, no, these tigers died naturally and we still have their bodies, just in case you thought that we sold them off.
How big of a problem is animal trafficking in Thailand?
It's a serious problem. Thailand sits between Myanmar and China and Laos. And this is the black market international trade in wildlife is estimated at $19 billion a year. There have been numerous accusations at a lot of places in Thailand where a lot of animals, endangered animals, have gone missing. And there has been some call to try and follow those up.
What are tigers used for? I mean, what are they trafficked for?
Tigers, it's a number of things. I've been to towns on the Burmese-China border where they sell tiger bone wine. That's considered a medicinal healing property. The fur itself obviously sells for a lot. The brain and the eyes. Essentially, you could use every part, and these animals will go for thousands, tens of thousands of dollars.
Such a grisly story. Jeez.
Yeah, it's pretty grim.
Adam Ramsey is a reporter based in Bangkok. He was speaking with my colleague, Carol Hills. Like Adam said, the Tiger Temple is no stranger to controversy. The temple got its first tiger in 1999, and for well over a decade, people have been accusing the monks of mistreatment. We have a timeline up on our Tumblr. That would be pritheworld.tumblr.com. You're listening to The World. Crossing borders, finding a new home. We do a lot of these kind of stories on the show. There are, after all, a lot of people who are crossing borders to new homes all over the globe. But this story's got a twist. We need to go back about 16 years to the Lebanese city of Saida, when a Syrian man and his family took up residence in a decrepit old building. Rebecca Collard picks up the story from there.
When Jihad al-Mohammed moved into this building, it was abandoned. Before, there were a lot of people who stayed here, says Mohammed, but it was filled with rats and garbage, so I cleaned it up. That was 1990. Mohammed had moved to Saida from Syria for work and was looking for a place to live. Palestinian refugees had used the building as a shelter during Lebanon's civil war, but they'd left, Mohammed says. He and his wife removed the garbage and moved in. At first glance, the building looks like many of the structures in Saida's old city, with high dome ceilings and arches. Then Mohammed takes me into his living room and points up at the windows. High above the marble floors, now covered with carpets, you can see Stars of David in the bars on the windows. This used to be a Jewish place of worship, says Mohammed. He says it took him almost a decade to realize he was living in a synagogue. I didn't know it when I came here, but people kept calling this area the Jewish Quarter, he says. And then tourists started coming by and asking to see my home. That's when I realized what it was. Mohammed shows me how he's divided the building into different rooms, bedrooms for his children, one for him and his wife, a kitchen, and the living room. Where the Torah scrolls were once kept, Mohammed has a flat-screen TV and a Wi-Fi router. The Hebrew letters that were once on the walls have been painted over. Saida used to have a thriving Jewish community, one that stretched back more than 2,000 years. A few streets over from Mohammed's home, Naji Georges Zidane shows me what was once a Jewish school. Zidane has researched the history of Lebanon's Jews and is writing a book about them. In 1974, there were still 1,500 Jews living in Saida, says Zidane. But then came the civil war, and the last Jewish families fled the city, along with thousands of others. The scars of that war are still visible on many of the buildings here. On the edge of the old city near the sea, Zidane points out a simple two-story stone building. You see where those young guys are? Zidane says, pointing to a balcony. That was the Levy's house. The Levy family was the last Jewish family in Saida. When they left in the early 1980s, the synagogue was abandoned. Millennia of Jewish history here came to an end. Back at Mohammed's home, he shows me photos on his phone of the many visitors he's received over the years from the U.S., Canada, and Europe. He stops on a picture of two rabbis who visited in 2012. They came and they prayed here, says Mohammed. Now he regularly has people knocking on his door. He's become something of an unlikely guardian for this ancient house of worship. But the building itself is decaying. The blue paint is peeling and pieces of the walls and ceiling fall off every day. Still, for Mohammed, this is home. And he says he plans to stay here as long as he's allowed and to keep welcoming visitors. For the world, Rebecca Collard, Saida, Lebanon.
Here's a headline for you. Sausage-wielding militants raid vegan cafe. That is not from The Onion. This actually happened in downtown Tbilisi, the capital of the former Soviet Republic of Georgia. Luckily, reporter and friend of the show Natalia Antalava is at the cafe to check up on the story. So the raid was on Sunday, Natalia. Is it back to business as usual at the Kiwi Cafe?
It is very much back to business as usual. In fact, the place is packed, and I think they've been getting a lot of support, and people have been making a point of coming here. They do also have an excellent falafel. But yes, the headline is extraordinary. They all seem to be quite shocked to be suddenly in the center of attention. This is a not-for-profit cafe. I mean, in some ways, it's a sort of a typical kind of hipster joint, very relaxed, all vegan, run by a bunch of friends who volunteer, doesn't make them any money at all. And on Sunday, they had a movie night. So the cafe, which has about 5 or 6 tables, it's pretty small. It was full. People were watching a film when about 10 or 15, no one seems to know the exact number, men came in. Some of them, bizarrely, were wearing sausage necklaces around their necks, carrying pieces of meat that they started throwing at the plates of the people at the cafe. And all of that kind of turned into a brawl. Four of the cafe Kiwi staff were beaten up, not very seriously, but certainly really, really unpleasant incident. And everyone, I was just talking to the couple who run it, and they were saying that they are quite traumatized by what happened, and also quite taken aback by all the attention that it has been receiving.
Well, nothing like a little publicity of any sort to get you some new business. But I mean, these militant meat eaters, who are they? Where are they from?
Yeah, the sausage wielding extremists that have put Georgia on the map. I mean, you couldn't make it up. We don't know is the answer. There are some suspicions of two groups have been named, one a nationalist group, another one a neo-Nazi group, who are not very active normally. I mean, most people didn't even know they existed when this happened. None of them have either claimed responsibility or admitted having done that. The police say that they are investigating. No one was arrested on the spot, even though the police did arrive. And there's a lot of unhappiness about that because people feel that things should have moved quicker with the investigation. It's now been, 2 days? And
why do people think the police didn't act quickly enough or take this seriously enough?
Well, I think, you know, weird as it all is, it also somehow fits into the reality of today's Georgia, a country which has moved very quickly towards democratization, has changed a lot in the last few years, but at the same time, a country that's very traditional, very Orthodox Christian, very unwilling to let go of its traditions. And everything that's weird, I was just talking to the guys at the Cafe Kiwi, the owners, and they were saying, you know, the neighbors don't like us. We've got piercings, we've got tattoos, we've got dreadlocks. They think we're weird. They think we're dirty. And it's very much the same sentiment that drives, they say, the anti-gay violence here. And there's been quite a few. Only recently, a guy was beaten up in the street for wearing an earring. It's not as bad as in some of the other places in the former Soviet Union, but it's certainly getting worse, this intolerance towards anything that is different. And in that sense, this kind of, you know, suddenly portraying meat as a great protector of Georgian traditions on some bizarre level, it actually sort of makes sense. It's the same people who say, you know, oh, no, we can't embrace the West because, you know, they allow homosexuality and that's just unacceptable.
Reporter Natalia Antalava in Tbilisi, Georgia, just outside the Kiwi Cafe. Thank you very much, Natalia.
Thanks, Marco.
Still ahead, an expected spike in immigration raids, but do they actually deter illegal immigration here on The World? I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, Cuban jazz great Arturo Sandoval remembers the first time he met Dizzy Gillespie in Havana.
Dizzy, I have only one question. Ask this guy, he got a car. And I say, yes, I have a little car. He said, okay, show me the city. I've never been here before. I can't wait.
More stories from Arturo Sandoval. That's ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, is in the news again this week. That's because of a pre-trial hearing there for five September 11th suspects. But today we want to step back from the courtroom proceedings and look at what life is like these days at this controversial prison. Miami Herald correspondent Carol Rosenberg has followed events at Gitmo since the detention facility opened in 2002, and she's there this week. Rosenberg says this is a relatively calm moment at the prison, so calm, in fact, that some detainees are attending 30-minute health and wellness classes. Rosenberg says the classes are taught by Navy medics who were originally brought to the island to deal with detainee hunger strikers.
They were force feeding as many as 48 on a single day, and they were checking everybody's health. Now they say a handful of the detainees are on hunger strike, and this Navy medical staff has time to spare. So they've been teaching little mini 30-minute modules, breathing exercise, the need to wash your hands a lot to avoid infection. It really is a reflection of coexistence right now at the detention center.
And only 80 detainees? There was a high of 600 detainees in 2003. Does it feel empty right now?
You know, somebody once said that when and if Obama gets the detention center closed, Guantanamo would be like a auto factory town after the factories shut down. There's 80 detainees, but they're still maintaining between 1,950 and 2,200 staff members. Most of them are troops. So you have soldiers to supervise soldiers, to supervise soldiers who are actually on the cell blocks. Some of the staff are maintaining the dining room. Those are civilians. They've got to feed everybody. There's a movie theater for the guards. So there's people who have to maintain housing. It's like a redundant yet complex operation that's gotten more complex through the years as the detention center is downsized.
What does all this tell us where Guantanamo is headed after Obama? And let's go with the assumption that Obama will not get a chance to close Guantanamo.
They are looking at consolidating possibly into fewer buildings where they keep the 80 detainees, but they haven't made that decision yet. They're beginning to talk about whether to widen the cells inside the actual steel and cement prison buildings to accommodate wheelchairs. So they're thinking way down the road, because most of these detainees are in their 30s and 40s. None of them are using a wheelchair at this point. We know there'll be fewer than 80 by the time President Obama leaves office, because there are some detainees in the pipeline to leave. That sort of contributes to why there's a good mood here right now. All the commanders are talking about the light at the end of the tunnel, but they know, Marco, that it's going to be extinguished, because they're thinking about the day after the last transfer, and they're thinking that the mood is going to sour.
You know, every time I speak with you, Carol, it just gets harder and harder to reconcile these different visions we get of Gitmo. You've written about the PlayStations the detainees have access to, new couches, microwaves, breathing exercises, and of the chairs that some detainees were once strapped to for force feedings. You've covered this place for 14 years. Do you still have difficulty making sense of it?
I believe what they're telling us, that this is a pretty good moment, that there's only two men in orange jumpsuits signifying that they're violent or misbehaving in some way, and that the rest are wearing the brown and white of the compliant. And I think that part of that is, like I said, people in the chute, and part of that is that Ramadan's starting in a few days, and this place really does settle down and get peaceful at Ramadan. I used to be able to cover it. I used to get several days of access in and out of the prison during Ramadan. They're shutting down media operations, so I have to take them on their word at it. But I do think this is a good moment for Guantanamo. I also think that it will end and that it will get ugly. I'm the reporter, Marco, and if they're not giving us the access, it's going to be hard to continue to believe them that it's going as well as they say it is if they keep shutting us out.
Always great to speak with you, Carol. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
By the way, Carol gave us a heads up about tomorrow's proceedings. She's expecting we'll learn more about a secret Gitmo prison called Camp 7 and perhaps even hear testimony from a prisoner who hasn't been seen in public since 2002.
Tomorrow's the big day. We're going to see Abu Zubaydah, the man who was the first prisoner of the CIA to undergo these experimental, brutal interrogations. And he's never been seen in court or anywhere since he disappeared into the dark sites in 2002. So we get Abu Zubaydah talking about what's going on in the secret prison at Guantanamo called Camp 7.
The Miami Herald's Carol Rosenberg at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center in Cuba. Stay with the world. This week, we'll have ongoing coverage from Gitmo. Summer is coming, and usually that means more people coming across the U.S. southern border illegally. And this year, more people than ever are expected to cross. Mostly, it's Central Americans fleeing violence at home. The predicted surge has the U.S. government worried. We've already heard news recently that immigration agents are planning to ramp up deportations through targeted raids in the coming weeks. Big question, though, does that strategy actually deter others from coming? The World's Monica Campbell has our story from Oakland, California.
Hola.
Hola.
When I meet Sandra, she's worried about the coming raids, like a lot of people in this neighborhood.
Sentimos temor de que nos vengan a tocar las puertas.
I'm afraid agents are going to knock on our door, deport us to Honduras, she says. Thing is, Sandra really shouldn't worry about being deported. She has a lawyer, and she has an asylum case open that protects her for now. Still, she says, the news has her blood pressure soaring and afraid to open the door.
O sea, no tenemos todavía una seguridad.
What if I don't get asylum, she wonders. Plus, her husband is undocumented too. Because of this uncertainty, Sandra asked to use her first name only. Her lawyer, Laura Polstein, tries to calm her, but says this fear, it's typical.
People become very afraid and the rumors start up. Before an arrest even happens, the harm is already done.
What a lot of people miss, she says, is that the raids are targeting immigrants who've lost their case in court and have been ordered deported by a judge. That's true, says Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. In an emailed statement, the agency also added that it must, quote, enforce the law and prioritize public safety and border security. But John Sandwick, who ran ICE for several years, says these raids, which aren't very widespread in reality, end up scaring entire communities in the U.S., and they don't stop people from coming.
What's going on right now is not working. Since a lot of these actions have been implemented, it has done nothing to dissipate, you know, the growth in the number of people attempting to cross. You know, we're dealing with an unprecedented humanitarian crisis in Central America. The solution to this is not, it's not in what we do here in this country, but is in what happens down there and what we can do down there to help.
I asked Sandra about this too. If she'd heard about the raids beforehand, would she have still left for the U.S.? Yes, she says, and then tells me why she left Honduras. It's when the gangs came to recruit her son.
Que si no les entregaba al niño, o sea que para reclutamiento.
Hand him over or we'll kill you, they said. Her son was 12. She wouldn't do it, but the threats were real. So within hours, Sandra fled with her kids and headed north to Oakland, where her husband works as a plumber. But first, Sandra and her sons had to bus through Mexico. That's when an armed cartel stopped them. They asked each passenger for the password. You had one if you paid protection money beforehand. Sandra didn't do that. She didn't have a password. So the men took her and her boys and stashed them in a room with other migrants. They called her husband, relatives, $4,500 ransom or else. The family hustled and paid, and Sandra and her sons were let go. They crossed the border, and with her kids dehydrated and exhausted, Sandra waved down the first car she saw. It was a cop who took the family to immigration officials. Next, they spent months in detention, and now hope to win asylum and stay in Oakland. She's afraid of being deported, but that fear, it doesn't compare to what she and her kids faced in Honduras and in Mexico.
No me hubiera detenido por ningún momento, yo me hubiera detenido.
She says she'd do it all again for her kids' safety. Wouldn't think twice about it. I also ask her what the U.S. should do. A lot of people don't want migrants crossing the border illegally. Sandra understands that, but says,
porque si nosotros llegamos a nuestro país, los que estamos amenazados de muerte,
we wouldn't last more than 3 days back in Honduras before the gangs come for us, she says. We're refugees. Meantime, her kids are doing well here. In their tiny one-bedroom apartment, her youngest son, very shy, watches TV. I ask which program.
Clifford?
Clifford the Big Red Dog on PBS. Sandra's older son, the one the gang tried to recruit, he's at a science fair.
Gracias a Dios, es bien inteligente.
Sandra beams, says he's getting honors. Now she hopes her kids can stay in the U.S. and not worry about being sent back. For The World, Monica Campbell, Oakland, California.
If you were to ask Cuban nationalists, they might call this communist music. The band here is Irakere, or should I say, the original lineup of Irakere, one of Havana's greatest bands ever. Because over the decades, there have been some notable changes in the group, perhaps none more significant than the defection of its Cuban co-founders, Paquito de Rivera and trumpeter Arturo Sandoval. For the rest of today's show, we're going to focus on the man on that trumpet, Arturo Sandoval. These are interesting times for Cubans, with relations between the U.S. and Cuba softening up a lot, but especially for Cubans who've defected. As you'll hear in a few minutes, Sandoval has his own dramatic defection story. Sandoval's skeptical about the opening with Cuba, but optimistic. He even called Barack Obama before the president went to Cuba in March. Sandoval says he warned the president that Cubans are still being imprisoned and that the Castros are not to be trusted. Sandoval has reason to be wary. After all, when he lived under the Castro regime, he was jailed for 3 months just for listening to jazz on Voice of America. Sandoval was in his early 20s at the time. Shortly after that, he fell in love with a woman, Marianela, who happened to work for the communist government. And yeah, even though he was in love, politics did affect the relationship.
In the very beginning, that was kind of difficult because we really fell in love, and we still, after 41 years of marriage. And
congratulations.
Thank you so much. I love that woman with my heart. But I'm going to tell you, in the beginning, she was... I never took it personal with her because I knew she wasn't alone. She belongs to a million of people that were confused about the whole thing because they paint their story like something beautiful they're going to do for the people and so many promises that it became a bunch of lies. And later on, to be honest, when she really finally opened her eyes and discovered the reality and threw it about, she became harder than me against the government. And I have to hold her a few times and say, honey, please, 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 we're going to end in jail, you and me. Please take it easy and then let's figure it out how we can get out of here.
Back when you first met her, no one came to your wedding, I gather, because they knew about your politics. Now, so they didn't show up at the wedding because they figured the government might be watching and they didn't want to be associated with you, or because they sincerely hated your politics?
No, she worked for the government like everybody else, but she worked in very important office of foreign office minister or whatever. And everybody there was a member of the Communist Party and everything. And they don't want to be associated with a guy who really loved jazz and loved the U.S. and was a musician. Because a musician, for their mentality, they don't consider us like a first-class people. Mm. You're a musician, you are no something respectable.
Right.
Yeah.
So
that's another stupid concept, you know. I have to deal with that for years.
Yeah, you know the old joke where the kid says to his parents, when I grow up, I want to be a musician. And the father says, well, you're going to have to choose one or the other.
Oh, you grew up, oh, you're a musician. You cannot achieve
grow up
both.
Or be a musician. You can't do both.
You cannot achieve both at the same time.
We had a few laughs during our interview, especially as he told me about meeting his musical hero, Dizzy Gillespie.
Early morning, somebody called me, a friend of mine who worked in the musician union. And he said, Arturo, I know you're a big fan of Dizzy Gillespie. He's coming this afternoon to Havana. And I said, well, that's a good joke. And he said, no, I'm very serious, man. But don't say anything that I told you this because I could be in serious problem.
That's Sandoval taking off on a solo on the classic A Night in Tunisia, the late great Dizzy Gillespie on the other trumpet. And that's where we're going to pick up the Arturo Sandoval story, to the time he met Diz, his hero. This was 1977. Dizzy was the headliner on a jazz cruise in the Caribbean, and there was a brief stopover in Havana. Sandoval got word and headed to the harbor to meet him.
At that time, I have a very old car. It was a Plymouth 1951. It was falling apart. And I just painted with gasoline and tar. That smelled horrible and looks
nice
worse.
Nice color.
Yes, and it smelled worse and looks worse. You know, and the passenger door doesn't open. It was locked. And then, okay, but Dizzy, I have only one question. He looked at him and me and he said, ask this guy, he got a car. And I say, yes, I have a little car. He said, okay, show me the city. I've never been here before. I can't wait.
So Sandoval drove Dizzy around Havana, playing the chauffeur. Dizzy had no idea Sandoval even played trumpet. But later that evening at a jam session, Dizzy found out.
I was backstage there, warming up a little bit, when Dizzy arrived. And then he look at me and open his eyes and drop his chin, you know, open his mouth like this. I'm sorry, my French, but he said, what the hell my driver is doing with the trumpet? And somebody said, no, he's a trumpet player. This is a, hell no, he's my driver. And, you know, I knew, of course, a bunch of his licks and phrases and things and his tunes or whatever. And he was laughing and laughing and laughing because later on he confessed, he said, man, I weren't expecting to hear a good piano player, a good saxophone player, a good trumpet player over here. I was expecting, of course, to hear some good percussionists and things like that and good dancers and singers or whatever. But to be honest, I weren't prepared to hear a good trumpet player over here. And then he come back to New York and started to talk to everybody. This really put us in the map, to be honest. We never going to say enough or be grateful enough for what he did for all of us.
But Dizzy also helped out Arturo Sandoval in one other major way. In 1990, Sandoval and his family were fed up with Cuba. They wanted out. At the time, Sandoval was on tour with the Dizzy Gillespie Orchestra in Europe. Sandoval's wife and son were laying low in London. Somehow, Cuban authorities suspected something was brewing, and they figured they'd track down Sandoval's wife and son first. Late one night, Sandoval had a brief, tearful conversation with his wife and realized he was going to have to act fast. He and Dizzy were at their hotel on a tour date in Greece, and he called Dizzy's room.
I wake him up. That was one something in the morning. I said, Dizzy, I'm sorry to wake you up, but I need to talk to you. Then I went to his room. I explained him the whole situation. And then he was, you know, almost sleepy as most away. And I said, great, get my wallet there. I got a business card there that I'm going to use it now. And then a few months before, Dizzy was in the Air Force One.
In the presidential trip. Plane.
Yes, sir. Mm. And then a group of people, important people, included the vice president. At that time, it was Don Quayle.
Don Quayle,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, all those people gave Dizzy the business card. I said, Mr. Gillespie.
Incredible, even the vice president. Here, I'm the vice president. Here's my card.
Yes, sir. And I said, Dizzy, if you ever need us for anything, don't hesitate. This is our card. And then everybody, I said, and Dizzy told me, oh, give me my wallet. I got a bunch of cards there. I'm going to use one of those. And then it's very true. And he called the White House. And then I think it was a general or colonel, something I can't remember exactly. He talked to me and asked me a bunch of questions. I said, what is the problem? And explained everything. And I said, my preoccupation, my biggest worry is my wife and son there in London. And he said, give me an address. I'm going to send a car right away there and pick them up and bring them into the embassy in London. They're going to be safe there. Mm. And later on, he said, okay, the American ambassador in Rome going to call you in a few minutes. And they wake him up in the middle of the night. And then a gentleman called me and said, okay, jump in a plane and come to Rome. I'm going to wait for you there. When I get to Rome, three people from the Italian Cuban embassy, they were waiting for me in the airport. But since God, the stewardess came to me and they said, Mr. Sandoval, stay in your seat. Don't get off the plane.
Wow.
A couple of police officers from Italy gave me and proved it down. And when I was going downstairs, the official car from the American embassy pulled over and picked me up and drove me straight to the embassy. And those people were waiting for me in the airport.
A close call. If that car from the American embassy hadn't shown up at the bottom of the stairs to the plane, we might not be speaking with Arturo Sandoval today. I wanted to know if he'd ever consider going back to Cuba.
I still have some relatives, to be honest, but all my close family is over here, thanks God, thanks God. And to be honest, under the circumstance nowadays, how is the whole thing going on? I'm aware of everything that's going on there. Believe me, I don't turn my back on that, and I really need to wait until the democracy get established again, thanks God, someday before I die. And respect for human rights and all the minimum of respect for human rights have to reestablish there. And it's such a risk for the people who carry an American passport, like me, to go there, because you never know what they could do to you. It's unpredictable, and I don't want to take that risk, to be honest. No, there's no reason.
Arturo Sandoval, it's been really great speaking with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it very much.
And that's Arturo Sandoval leading his own band through his composition, Sanduga. It takes us out today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.